Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Picture this. You're a diplomat attending the 2009 G20 summit in London. You have to send a few emails, download a presentation you're giving tomorrow morning on nuclear security. So you pop into the internet cafe conveniently located off the lobby. But the thing is, it's not really an internet cafe. It's a fake internet cafe set up by British intelligence in partnership with the National Security Agency of the United States to lure diplomats and others just in case some valuable intel passes through their computers. This fake internet cafe trick turns out to be just one of about two dozen James Bond-like tricks that we now know the NSA has up its sleeve. Culling from the reporting and original source documents leaked by Edward Snowden, the Brian Lehrer Show has compiled a running list of what we know the NSA can do: hacking into email servers, tapping underwater fiber optic cables, monitoring online games, and lots, lots more. You can see the list at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show, or we've just tweeted it again. Follow us at Brian Lehrer. And joining us to go through the list and add a little context is Shane Harris, senior writer at Foreign Policy Magazine and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. Shane, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. It's good to talk to you again. Thanks.
And we know about the metadata program to monitor phone information, but let's go through a few of the crazier things on this list. Want to start with that fake internet cafe? Really?
Yeah, I think this is one of the more surprising. James Bond maybe is a good analogy for this. I mean, in the sense that they are looking for communications from foreign diplomats and dignitaries and government officials, that in and of itself is not that surprising. But the setup that they used of actually sort of luring people into what they supposed was a safe place for sending communications, that's a pretty stunning one, and very clever, obviously. I mean, obviously, this was a summit that was held in London, so it was a little bit easier for the British to do this.
Of course, it's a real internet cafe in that they can actually send and receive messages and do all the things you would do online. It's just completely also a pipeline to intelligence, right?
Right. Think of it that, I mean, basically everything that they're doing on those computers is being watched and being copied by the GCHQ, which is the Brits surveillance agency, and then also shared with us. So they're going about doing their business thinking that perhaps no one's watching them, when in fact someone is watching or recording everything that they're typing and everything that they're sending.
And there are a number of other things on the list along those same lines. The NSA can set up fake cell phone base stations to intercept phone calls, or fake wireless networks to then capture data. Any of this surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me in the aggregate. I mean, I'm a little bit biased as somebody who spent a number of years researching a book on the NSA. Many of these things are what you would expect a very large intelligence agency with a very large budget as it has to be able to try to do. But when you drill down into some of these specific examples, some of them are really stunning. There are feats of ingenuity on display here. There's trickery, there's deception. Again, things that you would associate with an intelligence agency. But when you list them out the way that you all have, it is quite arresting, I think.
And on those kinds of things, the fake wireless networks, the fake internet cafe, isn't there some sort of entrapment going on there?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, if you think about intelligence in terms of, is there a morality or any kind of legality to intelligence and how it's practiced among nations, there really isn't. I mean, a lot of these officials who I gather had their communications slurped up at this internet cafe arguably should have known or expected that the British intelligence service would try to spy on them when they were at an international summit meeting. I think the question maybe becomes more acute when we're talking about the agency spying on ordinary people or on gathering communications from private individuals as opposed to trying to spy on diplomats, which is something that intelligence services have been doing to each other, for centuries, really.
Listeners, any questions or comments about our list of what the NSA can do? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. All right, let's keep going down this list. A few others that might surprise people. They can hack into the UN video conferencing system, can intercept communications between aircraft and airports. They can physically intercept deliveries, open packages, and make changes to devices. And on yesterday's show, we mentioned that the NSA could set up a fake LinkedIn account, but I actually misspoke. It can set up a fake LinkedIn, like set up an entire fake social network to lure people into joining and saying whatever it is that the NSA is looking for. Any others along those lines that you would add?
You know, you're getting now into these very kind of like almost exquisite examples of where really refined kind of, you know, high-end sort of targeting and, you know, setting up fake websites and the diversion of the shipments and all that. There's a very small group of really elite hackers within the NSA, maybe only a few hundred people who work on these projects at any one time. One of the ones that actually surprised me, which is not directly on your list, is the work that they did to reportedly insert a flawed encryption algorithm into a product manufactured by a company called RSA. Most people may not know what that company is, but chances are very good that you're the beneficiary of its encryption products when you send emails, when you bank, when you do any number of things online, and your data is kept secure and encrypted. Some years ago, it reportedly, the NSA arranged to install a backdoor effectively into one of those products so that it would give it access to unencrypted communications in the future. These are really highly specialized, specific applications that take time and a lot of engineering know-how to pull off and a lot of money to do it as well. It is extraordinary that we're learning such detail about these now. These are the kinds of things that you have listed here on the website are things that the NSA would look at and consider probably some of its biggest operational secrets. And I think probably their head has been spinning for the past 7 months that all of this stuff has now come out publicly.
Revealed by Snowden, and
yes,
including all these what you might call boutique spy operations.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned one that is not on our list, and folks, this list is open, whether you're Shane Harris, who wrote The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, or anybody else who knows something to propose that we confirm and add to the list, tweeted at Brian Lehrer. But do you have a sense of how big some of these boutique programs are? I mean, are there a dozen full-time employees at the NSA who spend their entire day exclusively trolling through online video games to monitor for terrorist activity, or are they trying smaller, shorter-term pilot projects to see what sticks? How much do you know?
Yeah, my sense is it is more the latter, that a lot of these, I mean, some of these documents that have come out appear to be from a moment in time, and it's not clear whether or not the projects had been going on for some time before or whether they continued. You know, the elite group that I mentioned before, which is called the Tailored Access Operations Group at NSA, these are the really high-end hackers. These are the ones who are responsible for doing things like diverting shipments of computers and installing surveillance equipment on them before they send them back on their way. I've heard from sources who've worked there that there are probably only about 300 people who work in that office. That is a very small number of people with a really high sort of skill set. Now, the agency itself has reportedly 30,000 people, but I think we have to presume that on these really high-end surveillance operations, it's a much smaller, it's a fraction of that overall workforce, and that they probably absolutely are trying things out, seeing what works, seeing what doesn't. You have a mention on the list here about the NSA trying to get into the Tor network, which is a routing service that allows people to connect to the Internet anonymously. It appears that from the documents that Snowden released, they tried quite unsuccessfully to overcome the anonymizing features of that network and very well may have stopped trying to foil it, at least for some time. Maybe they came back to it. But it would not be unexpected at all for them to try something. If it works, keep doing it. And if it doesn't, to abandon it and move on to something else, because, you know, they're limited with the number of people and the amount of money that they have. Even for an agency with a multi-billion-dollar budget, they have to be smart about how they invest that money.
Yeah. Did you see the great segment on the Colbert Report where they imagined an online video game where every character was actually an undercover NSA agent awkwardly trying to extract information from each other?
I didn't see that, but, you know, doesn't it just, like, raise the possibility? I mean, you wonder, I mean, how many of these times are they bumping into each other out there, and is this stuff actually working? I mean, that's like a great send-up.
Yeah, it's like a Cold War parody. Wait, you work for the NSA? I work for the NSA. Eric in Tenafly, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I just wanted to comment briefly about what nobody really talks about, and that the terrorist organizations and organized crimes don't utilize regular means of communications like text messages, emails, in order to send their plans from one to another. They use highly sophisticated encryption formats that are almost impossible to crack. And then when they do send content, they use code names and things. They don't put their full names and addresses and phone numbers like regular communication. Nobody's really talking about that and the futility of the entire NSA program to get real meaningful information about the massive terrorist organizations out there. You know, the bad guys know this is happening. They're taking steps way ahead of this to communicate in very, very covert ways.
Shane, what do you think about that? I mean, they do, right? There was an Al-Qaeda plot foiled last year when we found out that all of the main leaders were on a conference call together. So it's a really important question if we're going to, you know, debate the ethics of this, is also to understand the efficacy of this. So do these boutique programs, do these larger programs work to any extent that we can know?
It's a very, very difficult question to say, to look at one program and say, did this stop a terrorist attack? I mean, the best example we have of this is the collection of Americans' phone records, the so-called metadata program. The government started out when that was revealed by saying somewhere around 50 or so terrorist plots had been stopped. They scaled that number back. Subsequently, independent reviews have looked at this and questioned whether it stopped any attacks. But the NSA does not necessarily look at a particular program and measure its efficacy that way. They're not looking so much at did it or did it not stop an attack, because that's actually quite hard to measure. But how far into the network did we penetrate? How many leads did we generate? How much product, they'll call it that, product, did we generate out of this that ended up in an intelligence report for the president or for another senior official? You mentioned the instance of the so-called Al-Qaeda conference call of doom. That was actually just almost a bit of a stroke of luck that information was intercepted actually by an Air Force analyst and then was shared with the NSA. Occasionally, these systems and these programs that are in place are going to catch something, but it's, I think, very difficult to step back and measure each one on how many plots it has stopped or how many it has missed. But, you know, the caller points to something that is so fundamental to this. The reason why the NSA is working so hard to break encryption, to penetrate networks like Tor, to overcome a lot of these other obstacles on the Internet is because criminals and terrorist groups are using those very technologies to hide what they're doing.
And
that is the motivation for the NSA in many cases to do what it's doing here.
And I guess the companion question, if, as you say, the NSA is freaking out at how many of these boutique programs and other super secret things Snowden actually revealed, the companion question is, what has been damaged in terms of national security by letting these things out? Is that a knowable topic?
I think likewise, that's also hard to know. A number of senior administration officials have now said publicly on the record that the Snowden leaks did do damage to national security. The most specific that they have gotten is to say that the Al-Qaeda cells and groups that they have been monitoring, in their view, have changed their tactics as a result of the leaks. They're trying to do things now to evade the surveillance that's out there, or what they think it can do. The National Counterterrorism Director recently said that they've picked up chatter among Al-Qaeda operatives talking about the Snowden leaks. So in their mind, yes, it has had some effect. But again, very difficult to measure. And I would also just, you know, underscore here, this is to some degree is the price you pay in living in an open society. I mean, to say nothing for, you know, put aside the question of Mr. Snowden's motives or whether it did or not do damage, when journalists report on these things, we try and do the best that we can to minimize sensitive operational information, but you weigh that against the public's right and the need to know about this information. So you can't have, you know, transparency of an intelligence system in a free society without running the risk that you will jeopardize intelligence operations to some extent.
I think Derek on the Upper West Side has a question about one of the things we mentioned from the list. Derek, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Love your show.
Thank you.
You mentioned earlier about the NSA capabilities of tapping fiber optics, and I thought you said undersea fiber optics, but I wasn't quite sure. The reason for my query, and hopefully the author can lend some detail on it, is I worked on a UN project back in 99 or 98, I think it was, and I had a magazine, a internal UN publication magazine, that had an article that said that the NSA tapped an undersea fiber optic cable between England and France and pulled out the Airbus bid on a big project for a new plane, gave it to Boeing, and then Boeing submitted a bid to beat the Airbus bid by one nickel U.S. the interesting thing was last year or the year before, Richard Clark delivered a lecture or something and claimed specifically that the NSA had never spied on commercial businesses to advantage U.S. businesses. And yesterday or the day before, President Obama said that the NSA would not basically do the same thing, spy for commercial purposes. And could you comment on this undersea fiber optic? Because that's got to be really hard to do.
Shane, how familiar are you with that?
Yeah, so it's kind of two questions there. I mean, the case of Airbus and Boeing was one that came up in the late 90s, as your caller said. I'm not as deeply familiar with that as some other cases, but that was an allegation that had been made that the NSA was engaging in industrial espionage, stealing information from a foreign company and giving it to an American competitor so that they could get a leg up. It's something that the agency denied. I believe there were hearings on it in the European Parliament or in the EU. The NSA today insists that they do not engage in that kind of economic espionage. However, what they will do is spy on foreign trade ministers. They will spy on government officials to try and figure out where their countries are going in trade negotiations and other international negotiations so that American officials can get a leg up on that. So it's a variation on the economic-themed espionage, if not actually giving secrets to a corporation. As for the undersea cables, there have been documented cases where NSA has actually used submarines to try and tap cables underneath the water and has had some success with doing that. But more likely than not, what they're doing today is actually tapping the cables when they come to shore, either at those sort of landing stations or in the offices of the companies that own and operate that equipment around the world.
Derek, thank you for your call. And I want to go to a comments page comment by David, who writes, "It seems to me that the NSA has evolved from a useful public service person into a demented hoarder who collects everything without knowing what to do with it all. So how insatiable is the NSA's appetite, or should we see this as, you know, very targeted, very smart, even if they're broad ways of trying to protect the country, whether or not we think they're constitutional?"
Well, I think that your caller is putting their finger on something important here, which is that the NSA's strategy is that if they're trying to find the proverbial needle in a haystack, right, they need to collect the entire haystack. So there is this, I think, arguably insatiable quest to collect information and to store it because they don't know what particular piece of information might be valuable and when. The metadata program, again, the phone records program of Americans, it's a great example. Keith Alexander, the agency director, has said publicly that they have to collect all that information so that at some point they have the ability to, his words, go back in time and rebuild someone's social network based on a phone number or a lead that they get. From their perspective, that is the best way that they know how to find useful information is to have access to all of the information going back as far as possible. So that is very much their philosophy, is to collect it. And, you know, if you want to use the word hoarding, I've used it before as well. What it tends to do is, I think, is put the emphasis more on the collection as opposed to the analysis and getting smarter about what you do with that information. And I think that's maybe been one of where the agency has actually been weak, is that it's focused too much on collecting the dots, if you will, rather than connecting them.
So the Guardian editor, Alan Rusbridger, recently said that the paper has only published 1% of the documents that Edward Snowden stole. So do you expect lots more revelations like this? Are there all sorts of new tricks that will come to light and be added to our list?
I think we have to presume that the answer is yes, yeah, that we're going to see more. Whether or not they will rise to the level of sort of, oh, wow, or be as eye-popping as these, who can say? You know, there have been a number of points in the past 7 months where I thought we had probably heard some of the most spectacular revelations, only to, you know, a week later for another one to drop in the press that just sort of blew my mind. Based on what we know about the number of documents he took and what reporters who received those documents have said, we have only seen, you know, a fraction of the information. And I know that the Guardian and the Post particularly are taking their time with these documents, and they're going through them very carefully and doing very thorough reporting. They're not in a rush to push this information out.
What do you make of the fact that the Guardian and the Times and the Washington Post have taken on this slow trickle approach to revealing NSA activities? I guess you just framed it as as basic caution. But every time we hear about a new weird program, there's a bit of a public outcry. And I wonder, do we have a right to know as a public everything right now, especially since the Obama administration is pledging to make changes based on the revelations, and we aren't going to be at this moment of policy change, you know, every 3 months?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that probably, you know, I would have to assume that that is some variation of the question that the editors and reporters at the Post and the Times and the Guardian and other publications are grappling with every day. If they believe that the information in these documents that the public has a need to know and has a right to know it, isn't there an argument to just go ahead and let people see it? From their standpoint, though, what they have said time and again that they want to do is apply sound journalistic methods to this, to be very cautious, to do their due diligence, to thoroughly report it. That is going to take time. And I mean, from a, personally, I think they've made the right choice. I think it is much smarter for them to go through this and apply good reporting and sound judgment to it than to release it all at once, even though if you did that, arguably, people would be able to get through the documents a lot faster. But then we wouldn't know if we were perhaps jeopardizing a program unnecessarily or revealing something that should really stay secret.
Last question. Is there anything you can definitively say the NSA cannot pull off, or will nothing cease to amaze you?
They can't read my mind yet.
I knew you were going to say that. They knew you were going to say that.
Exactly. You know, the one thing that I've been waiting to see whether they can do is actually insert viruses remotely into a computer. We know that they can communicate with viruses and malware already implanted on a machine via radio waves. That's one of the things that's on your list. You know, in my science fiction imagination, I believe they've invented some way to just remotely implant a device without ever having to touch it. But we'll see. We'll find out if I'm right about that.
So Shane Harris, senior writer at Foreign Policy Magazine and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State. As he tells us, it's the difference between collecting the dots and connecting them. And again, listeners, you can go to our webpage, WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehr Show, or go to our Twitter feed where we've just sent this out again, this list that our producer Jody Evergan has compiled from the Snowden documents as revealed in the press and other credible sources of things we now know that the NSA actually can do. Shane, thank you so much.
Brian, my pleasure. Thanks a lot.